from Winston Churchill's war memoirs, The French Agony.
To lessen the shock of the impending French surrender, it was necessary at this time to send a message to the Dominion Prime Ministers, showing them that our resolve to continue the struggle, although alone, was not based upon mere obstinacy or desperation, and to convince them by practical and technical reasons, of which they might well be unaware, of the real strength of our position. Prime Minister to the Prime Ministers of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. I do not regard the situation as having passed beyond our strength. It is by no means certain that the French will not fight on in Africa and at sea. But whatever they do, Hitler will have to break us in this island or lose the war. Our principal danger is his concentrated air attack by bombing, coupled with parachute and airborne landings, and attempts to run an invading force across the sea. This danger has faced us ever since the beginning of the war, and the French could never have saved us from it, as he could always switch on to us. Undoubtedly it is aggravated by the conquests Hitler has made upon the European coast, close to our shores. Nevertheless, in principle, the danger is the same. I do not see why we should not be able to meet it. The Navy has never pretended to prevent a raid of 5,000 or 10,000 men, but we do not see how a force of, say, 80,000 to 100,000 could be transported across the sea and still less maintained in the teeth of superior sea power. As long as our Air Force is in being, it provides a powerful aid to the fleet in preventing seaborne landings, and will take a very heavy toll of airborne landings. Although we have suffered heavy losses by assisting the French, and during the Dunkirk evacuation, we have managed to husband our air fighter strength in spite of poignant appeals from France to throw it improvidently into the great land battle which it could not have turned decisively. I am happy to tell you that it is now as strong as it has ever been, and that the flow of machines is coming forward far more rapidly than ever before. In fact, pilots have now become the limiting factor at the moment. Our fighter aircraft have been wont to inflict a loss of 2 or 2.5 to 1, even when fighting under adverse conditions in France. During the evacuation of Dunkirk, which was a sort of no man's land, we inflicted a loss of 3 or 4 to 1. And often saw German formations turn away from a quarter of their numbers of our planes. But all air authorities agree that the advantage in defending this country against an over-sea air attack will be still greater, because first we shall know pretty well by our various devices where they are coming, and because our squadrons lie close enough together to enable us to concentrate against the attackers and provide enough to attack both the bombers and the protecting fighters at the same time. All their shot-down machines will be total losses. Many of ours and our pilots will fight again. Therefore, I do not think it by any means impossible that we may so maul them that they will find daylight attacks too expensive. The major danger will be from night attack on our aircraft factories. But this again is far less accurate than the daylight attack, and we have many plans for minimizing its effect. Of course, their numbers are much greater than ours, but not so much greater as to deprive us of a good and reasonable prospect of wearing them out after some weeks or even months of air struggle. Meanwhile, of course, our bomber force will be striking continually at their key points, especially oil refineries and air factories, and at their congested and centralized war industry in the Ruhr. We hope our people will stand up to this bombardment as well as the enemy. It will, on both sides, be on an unprecedented scale. All our information goes to show that the Germans have not liked what they have got so far. It must be remembered that now that the BEF is at home and largely rearmed or rearming, if not upon a continental scale, at any rate good enough for home defense, we have far stronger military forces in this island than we have ever had in the late war or in this war. Therefore, we hope that such numbers of the enemy as may be landed from the air or by seaborne raid will be destroyed and be an example to those who try to follow. No doubt we must expect novel forms of attack and attempts to bring tanks across the sea. We are preparing ourselves to deal with these as far as we can foresee them. No one can predict or guarantee the course of a life and death struggle of this character, but we shall certainly enter upon it in good heart. I have given you this full explanation to show you that there are solid reasons behind our resolve not to allow the fate of France, whatever it may be, to deter us from going on to the end. I personally believe that the spectacle of the fierce struggle and carnage in our island will draw the United States into the war, and even if we should be beaten down through the superior numbers of the enemy's air force, it will always be possible, as I indicated to the House of Commons in my last speech, to send our fleets across the oceans where they will protect the Empire and enable it to continue the war and the blockade, I trust, in conjunction with the United States, until the Hitler regime breaks under the strain. We shall let you know at every stage how you can help, being assured that you will do all in human power, as we, for our part, are entirely resolved to do. I composed this in the cabinet room, and it was typed as I spoke. The door to the garden was wide open, and outside the sun shone warm and bright. Air Chief Marshal Newall, the Chief of the Air Staff, sat on the terrace meanwhile. When I had finished revising the draft, I took it out to him in case there were any improvements or corrections to be made. He was evidently moved, and presently said he agreed with every word. I was comforted and fortified myself by putting my convictions upon record. And when I read the message over the final time before sending it off, I felt a glow of sober confidence. This was certainly justified by what happened. All came true.
The Second World War, Chapter 11. Admiral d'Arlon and the French fleet.
In the closing days at Bordeaux, Admiral d'Arlon became very important. My contacts with him had been few and formal. I respected him for the work he had done in recreating the French Navy, which, after 10 years of his professional control, was more efficient than any time since the French Revolution. When in November 1939 he had visited England, we gave him an official dinner at the Admiralty. In response to the toast, he began by reminding us that his great-grandfather had been killed at the Battle of Trafalgar. I therefore thought of him as one of those good Frenchmen who hate England. Our Anglo-French naval discussions in January had shown how very jealous the Admiral was of his professional position in relation to whoever was the political minister of Marine. This had become a positive obsession, and I believe played a definite part in his action. For the rest, d'Arlon had been present at most of the conferences which I have described, and as the end of the French resistance approached, he had repeatedly assured me that whatever happened, the French fleet should never fall into German hands. Now at Bordeaux came the fateful moment in the career of this ambitious, self-seeking, and capable admiral. His authority over the fleet was for all practical purposes absolute. He had only to order the ships to British, American, or French colonial harbors, some had already started, to be obeyed. In the morning of June 17, after the fall of Mr. Renault's cabinet, he declared to General George that he was resolved to give the order. The next day, George met him in the afternoon and asked him what had happened. D'Arlon replied that he had changed his mind. When asked why, he answered simply, "I am now Minister of Marine." This did not mean he had changed his mind in order to become Minister of Marine, but that being Minister of Marine, he had a different point of view. How vain are human calculations of self-interest. Rarely has there been a more convincing example. Admiral d'Arlon had but to sail in any one of his ships to any port outside France to become the master of all French interests beyond German control. He would not have come like General de Gaulle, with only an unconquerable heart and a few kindred spirits. He would have carried with him, outside the German reach, the fourth navy in the world, whose officers and men were personally devoted to him. Acting thus, d'Arlon would have become the chief of the French resistance with a mighty weapon in his hand. British and American dockyards and arsenals would have been at his disposal for the maintenance of his fleet. The French gold reserve in the United States would have assured him, once recognized, of ample resources. The whole French Empire would have rallied to him. Nothing could have prevented him from being the liberator of France. The fame and power which he so ardently desired were in his grasp. Instead, he went forward through 2 years of worrying and ignominious office to a violent death at his honored grave, and a name long to be execrated by the French Navy and the nation he had hitherto served so well. There is a final note which should be struck at this point, in a letter which d'Arlon wrote to me on December the 4th, 1942, just 3 weeks before his assassination. He vehemently claimed that he had kept his word. It cannot be disputed that no French ship was ever manned by the Germans or used against us by them in the war. This was not entirely due to Admiral d'Arlon's measures, but he had certainly built up in the minds of the officers and men of the French Navy that at all costs their ships should be destroyed before being seized by the Germans, whom he disliked as much as the English.
London, July 14th, 1940. The War of the Unknown Warriors, a world broadcast.
During the last fortnight, the British Navy, in addition to blockading what is left of the German fleet and chasing the Italian fleet, has had imposed upon it the sad duty of putting effectually out of action for the duration of the war the capital ships of the French Navy. These, under the armistice terms signed in the railway coach at Compiègne, would have been placed within the power of Nazi Germany. The transference of these ships to Hitler would have endangered the security both of Great Britain and the United States. We therefore had no choice but to act as we did, and to act forthwith. Our painful task is now completed. Although the unfinished battleship, the Jean Bart, still rests in a Moroccan harbor, and there are a number of French warships at Toulon and in various French ports all over the world, these are not in a condition or of a character to derange our preponderance of naval power. As long, therefore, as they make no attempt to return to ports controlled by Germany or Italy, we shall not molest them in any way. That melancholy phase in our relations with France has, so far as we are concerned, come to an end. And now it has come to us to stand alone in the breach and face the worst that the tyrant's might and enmity can do. Bearing ourselves humbly before God, but conscious that we serve an unfolding purpose, we are ready to defend our native land against the invasion by which it is threatened. We are fighting by ourselves alone, but we are not fighting for ourselves alone. Here in this strong city of refuge, which enshrines the title deeds of human progress and is of deep consequence to Christian civilization, here, girt about by the seas where the navy reigns, shielded from above by the prowess and devotion of our airmen, we await undismayed the impending assault. Perhaps it will come tonight. Perhaps it will come next week. Perhaps it will never come. We must show ourselves equally capable of meeting a sudden violent shock, or what is perhaps a harder test, a prolonged vigil. But be the ordeal sharp or long, or both,
We shall seek no terms. We shall tolerate no parley. We may show mercy. We shall ask none. But here, in our island, we are in good health and in good heart. We have seen how Hitler prepared in scientific detail the plans for destroying the neighbor countries of Germany. He had his plans for Poland and his plans for Norway. He had his plans for Denmark. He had his plans all worked out for the doom of the peaceful, trustful Dutch, and, of course, for the Belgians. We have seen how the French were undermined and overthrown. We may therefore be sure that there is a plan, perhaps built up over years, for destroying Great Britain, which, after all, has the honor to be his main and foremost enemy. All I can say is that any plan for invading Britain, which Hitler made 2 months ago, must have had to be entirely recast in order to meet our new position. 2 months ago, nay, 1 month ago, our first and main effort was to keep our best army in France. All our regular troops, all our output of munitions, and a very large part of our air force had to be sent to France and maintained in action there. But now we have it all at home. Never before in the last war, or in this, have we had in this island an army comparable in quality, equipment, or numbers to that which stands here on guard tonight. We have 1.5 million men in the British Army under arms tonight. And every week of June and July has seen their organization, their defenses, and their striking power advance by leaps and bounds. No praise is too high for the officers and men, aye, and civilians, who have made this immense transformation in so short a time. Behind these, soldiers of the regular army, as a means of destruction for parachutists, airborne invaders, and any traitors that may be found in our midst, and I do not believe there are many, woe betide them, they will get short shrift. Behind the regular army, we have more than 1 million of the local defense volunteers, or as they are much better called, the Home Guard. These officers and men, a large proportion of whom have been through the last war, have the strongest desire to attack and come to close quarters with the enemy, wherever he may appear. Should the invader come to Britain, there will be no placid lying down of the people in submission before him, as we have seen, alas, in other countries. We shall defend every village, every town, and every city. The vast mass of London itself, fought street by street, could easily devour an entire hostile army, and we would rather see London laid in ruins and ashes than that it should be tamely and abjectly enslaved. I am bound to state these facts because it is necessary to inform our people of our intentions, and thus to reassure them. But all depends now upon the whole life strength of the British race in every part of the world, and of all our associated peoples, and of all our well-wishers in every land, doing their utmost night and day, giving all, daring all, enduring all, to the utmost, to the end. This is no war of chieftains or of princes, of dynasties or national ambitions. It is a war of peoples and of causes. There are vast numbers, not only in this island, but in every land, who will render faithful service in this war, but whose names will never be known, whose deeds will never be recorded. This is a war of the unknown warriors. But let all strive without failing, in faith or in duty, and the dark curse of Hitler will be lifted from our age.
July 1940, at bay, from Chapter 13, the Second World War.
In these summer days of 1940, after the fall of France, we were all alone. None of the British dominions, or India, or the colonies, could send decisive aid, or send what they had in time. The victorious, enormous German armies, thoroughly equipped, and with large reserves of captured weapons and arsenals behind them, were gathering for the final stroke. Italy, with numerous and imposing forces, had declared war upon us and eagerly sought our destruction in the Mediterranean and in Egypt. In the Far East, Japan glared inscrutably and pointedly requested the closing of the Burma Road against supplies for China. Soviet Russia was bound to Nazi Germany by her pact and lent important aid to Hitler in raw materials. Spain, which had already occupied the international zone of Tangier, might turn against us at any moment and demand Gibraltar, or invite the Germans to help her attack it, or mount batteries to hamper passage through the straits. The France of Pétain and Bordeaux soon moved to Vichy, and might at any day be forced to declare war upon us. What was left at Toulon of the French fleet seemed to be in German power. Certainly we had no lack of foes. Deep alarm spread through the United States, and indeed through all the surviving free countries. Americans gravely asked themselves whether it was right to cast away any of their own severely limited resources to indulge a generous though hopeless sentiment. Ought they not to strain every nerve and nurse every weapon to remedy their own unpreparedness? It needed a very sure judgment to rise above these cogent, matter-of-fact arguments. The gratitude of the British nation is due to the noble President and his great officers and high advisers for never, even in the advent of the third term presidential election, losing their confidence in our fortunes or our will. The buoyant and imperturbable temper of Britain, which I had the honor to express, may well have turned the scale. Here was this people, who in the years before the war had gone to the extreme bounds of pacifism and improvidence, who had indulged in the sport of party politics, and who, though so weakly armed, had advanced light-heartedly into the center of European affairs, now confronted with the reckoning alike of their virtuous impulses and neglectful arrangements. They were not even dismayed. They defied the conqueror of Europe. They seemed willing to have their island reduced to a shambles rather than give in. This would make a fine page in history. But there were other tales of this kind. Athens had been conquered by Sparta. The Carthaginians made a forlorn resistance to Rome. Not seldom in the annals of the past, and how much more often in tragedies never recorded or long forgotten, had brave, proud, easygoing states and even entire races been wiped out so that only their name or even no mention of them remains. Few British and very few foreigners understood the peculiar technical advantages of our insular position, nor was it generally known how even in the irresolute years before the war, the essentials of sea and latterly air defense had been maintained. It was nearly 1,000 years since Britain had seen the fires of a foreign camp on English soil. There was also another aspect. One of our greatest dangers during June lay in having our last reserves drawn away from us into a wasting, futile French resistance in France, and the strength of our air forces gradually worn down by their flights or transference to the continent. If Hitler had been gifted with supernatural wisdom, he would have slowed down the attack on the French front, making perhaps a pause of 3 or 4 weeks after Dunkirk on the line of the Seine, and meanwhile developing his preparations to invade England. Thus he would have had a deadly option and could have tortured us with the hooks of either deserting France in our agony or squandering the last resources for our future existence. The more we urge the French to fight on, the greater was our obligation to aid them, and the more difficult it would have become to make any preparations for defense in England, and above all to keep in reserve the 25 squadrons of fighter aircraft on which all depended. On this point, we should never have given way, but the refusal would have been bitterly resented by our struggling ally and would have poisoned all our relations. It was even with an actual sense of relief that some of our high commanders addressed themselves to our new and grimly simplified problem. As the commissionaire at one of the service clubs in London said to a rather downcast member, "Anyhow, it's now we're in the final, and it's to be played on the home ground." As the months of July and August passed without any disaster, we settled ourselves down with increasing assurance that we could make a long and hard fight. Our gains of strength were borne in upon us from day to day. The entire population labored to the last limit of its strength and felt rewarded when they fell asleep after their toil or vigil by a growing sense that we should have time and that we should win. All the beaches now bristled with defenses of various kinds. The whole country was organized in defensive localities. The factories poured out their weapons. By the end of August, we had over 250 new tanks. The fruits of the American Act of Faith had been gathered. The whole trained professional British Army and its territorial comrades drilled and exercised from morn till night and longed to meet the foe. The Home Guard overtopped the million mark, and when rifles were lacking, grasped lustily the shotgun, the sporting rifle, the private pistol, or, when there was no firearm, the pike and the club. No fifth column existed in Britain, though a few spies were carefully rounded up and examined. What few communists there were lay low. Everyone else gave all they had to give. When Ribbentrop visited Rome in September, he said to Ciano, "The English territorial defense is non-existent. A single German division will suffice to bring about a complete collapse." This merely shows his ignorance. I have often wondered, however, what would have happened if 200,000 German stormtroops had actually established themselves ashore. The massacre would have been on both sides grim and great. There would have been neither mercy nor quarter. They would have used terror, and we were prepared to go all lengths. I intended to use the slogan, "You can always take one with you." I even calculated that the horrors of such a scene would in the last resort turn the scale in the United States. But none of these emotions was put to the proof. Far out on the grey waters of the North Sea and the Channel, coursed and patrolled the faithful, eager flotillas peering through the night. High in the air soared the fighter pilots, or waited serene at a moment's notice around their excellent machines. This was a time when it was equally good to live or die.
The House of Commons, London, 20th of August, 1940. The first year.
Rather more than a quarter of a year, Mr. Speaker, has passed since the new government came into power in this country. What a cataract of disaster had poured out upon us since then. The trustful Dutch overwhelmed, their beloved and respected sovereign driven into exile, the peaceful city of Rotterdam, the scene of a massacre as hideous and brutal as anything in the 30 years' war, Belgium invaded and beaten down, our own fine expeditionary force cut off and almost captured, escaping, as it seemed, only by a miracle, and with the loss of all its equipment. Our ally France out, Italy in against us, all France in the power of the enemy, all its arsenals and vast masses of military material converted or convertible to the enemy's use, a puppet government set up at Vichy, which may at any moment be forced to become our foe, the whole western seaboard of Europe, from the North Cape to the Spanish frontier, in German hands, All the ports, all the airfields on this immense front employed against us as potential springboards of invasion. Moreover, sir, the German air power, numerically so far outstripping ours, has been brought so close to our island that what we used to dread greatly has come to pass, and the hostile bombers not only reach our shores in a few minutes and from many directions, but can be escorted by their fighting aircraft. Why, sir, if we had been confronted at the beginning of May with such a prospect, it would have seemed incredible that at the end of a period of horror and disaster, or at this point in a period of horror and disaster, we should stand erect, sure of ourselves, masters of our fate, and with the conviction of final victory burning unquenchable in our hearts. Few would have believed we could survive. None would have believed that we should today not only feel stronger, but should actually be stronger than we have ever been before. Let us...
Mr. Churchill then went on.
The great air battle, which has been in progress over this island for the last few weeks, has recently attained a high intensity. It is too soon to attempt to assign limits either to its scale or to its duration. We must certainly expect that greater efforts will be made by the enemy than any he has put forth. Hostile airfields are still being developed in France and the Low Countries, and the movement of squadrons and material for attacking us is still proceeding. It is quite plain, sir, that Herr Hitler could not admit defeat in his air attack on Great Britain without sustaining most serious injury. If, after all his boastings and blood-curdling threats and lurid accounts trumpeted round the world of the damage he had inflicted, of the vast numbers of our air force he has shot down, so he says, with so little loss to himself, if after tales of the panic-stricken British crushed in their holes, cursing the plutocratic parliament which has led them to such a plight, if after all this his whole air onslaught were forced after a while tamely to peter out, the Führer's reputation for veracity of statement might be seriously impugned. We may be sure, therefore, that he will continue, as long as he has the strength to do so, and as long as any preoccupation he may have in respect of the Russian Air Force allow him to do so. On the other hand, the conditions and course of the fighting have so far been favorable to us. I told the House 2 months ago that whereas in France our fighter aircraft were wont to inflict a loss of 2 or 3 to 1 upon the Germans, and in the fighting at Dunkirk, which was a kind of no man's land, a loss of about 3 or 4 to 1, we expected that in an attack on this island we should achieve a larger ratio. This has certainly come true. It must also be remembered that all the enemy machines and pilots which are shot down over our island or over the seas which surround it are either destroyed or captured, whereas a considerable proportion of our machines and also of our pilots are saved and soon again, in many cases, come into action. The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. All our hearts go out to the fighter pilots whose brilliant actions we see with our own eyes day after day. But we must never forget that all the time, night after night, month after month, our bomber squadrons travel far into Germany, find their targets in the darkness by the highest navigational skill, aim their attacks, often under the heaviest fire, often with serious loss, with deliberate careful discrimination. and inflict shattering blows upon the whole of the technical and war-making structure of the Nazi power. On no part of the Royal Air Force does the weight of the war fall more heavily than on the daylight bombers, who will play an invaluable part in the case of invasion, and whose unflinching zeal it has been necessary, in the meanwhile, on numerous occasions, to restrain. I hope, indeed I pray, that we shall not be found unworthy of our victory if after toil and tribulation it is granted to us. For the rest, we have to gain the victory. That is our task. There is, however, one direction in which we can see a little more clearly ahead. We have to think not only for ourselves, but for the lasting security of the cause and principles for which we are fighting, and of the long future of the British Commonwealth of Nations. Some months ago, we came to the conclusion that the interests of the United States and of the British Empire both required that the United States should have facilities for the naval and air defense of the Western Hemisphere against the attack of a Nazi power, which might have acquired temporary but lengthy control of a large part of Western Europe and its formidable resources. We had therefore decided spontaneously, and without being asked or offered any inducement, to inform the government of the United States that we would be glad to place such defense facilities at their disposal by leasing suitable sites in our transatlantic possessions for their greater security against the unmeasured dangers of the future. The principle of association of interests for common purposes between Great Britain and the United States had developed even before the war. Various agreements had been reached about certain small islands in the Pacific Ocean which had become important as air fueling points. In all this line of thought, we found ourselves in very close harmony with the government of Canada. Presently, we learned that anxiety was also felt in the United States about the air and naval defense of the Atlantic seaboard, and President Roosevelt has recently made it clear that he would like to discuss with us and with the Dominion of Canada and with Newfoundland the development of American naval and air facilities in Newfoundland and in the West Indies. There is, of course, no question of any transference of sovereignty. That has never been suggested, or of any action being taken without the consent or against the wishes of the various colonies concerned. But for our own part, His Majesty's government are entirely willing to accord defense facilities to the United States on a 99 years leasehold basis. And we feel sure that our interests no less than theirs, and the interests of the colonies themselves and of Canada and Newfoundland, will be served thereby. Sir, these are important steps. Undoubtedly, this process means that these two great organizations of the English-speaking democracies, the British Empire and the United States, will have to be somewhat mixed up together in some of their affairs for mutual and general advantage. For my own part, looking out upon the future, I do not view the process with any misgivings. I could not stop it if I wished. No one can stop it. Like the Mississippi, it just keeps rolling along. Let it roll. Let it roll on, full flood, inexorable, irresistible, benignant, to broader lands and better days.
The crux of the whole war. A radio speech, September 11th, 1940, London.
When I said in the House of Commons the other day that I thought it improbable that the enemy's air attack in September could be more than three times as great as it was in August, I was not, of course, referring to barbarous attacks upon the civil population, but to the great air battle which is being fought out between our fighter and the German Air Force. This effort of the Germans to secure daylight mastery of the air over England is, of course, the crux of the whole war. So far, it has failed conspicuously. It has cost them very dear. And we have felt stronger and are actually and relatively a good deal stronger than when the hard fighting began in July. There is no doubt that Herr Hitler is using up his fighter force at a very high rate, and that if he goes on for many more weeks, he will wear down and ruin this vital part of his air force. That will give us a very great advantage. On the other hand, for him to try to invade this country without having secured mastery in the air would be a very hazardous undertaking. If this invasion is going to be tried at all, it does not seem that it can be long delayed. The weather may break at any time. Besides this, it is difficult for the enemy to keep these gatherings of ships waiting about indefinitely while they are bombed every night by our bombers and very often shelled by our warships, which are waiting for them outside. Therefore, we must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history. It ranks with the days when was approaching the Channel and Drake was finishing his game of bowls, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne. We've read about all this in the history books. But what is happening now is on a far greater scale and of far more consequence to the life and future of the world and its civilization than these brave old days of the past. Every man and woman will therefore prepare himself to do his duty, whatever it may be, with special pride and care. Our fleets and flotillas are very powerful and numerous. Our air force is at the highest strength it has ever reached, and it is conscious of its proved superiority, not indeed in numbers, but in men and machines. Our shores are well fortified and strongly manned, and behind them, ready to attack the invaders, we have a far larger and better equipped mobile army than we have ever had before. This is a time for everyone to stand together and hold firm, as they are doing. I express my admiration for the exemplary manner in which all the air raid precaution services of London are being discharged, especially the fire brigade, whose work has been so heavy and also dangerous. All the world that is still free marvels at the composure and fortitude with which the citizens of London are facing and surmounting the great ordeal to which they are subjected, the end of which, or the severity of which, cannot yet be foreseen. It is a message of good cheer to our fighting forces on the seas, in the air, and in our waiting armies, in all their posts and stations, that we send them from this capital city. They know that they have behind them a people who will not flinch or weary of the struggle, hard and protracted though it will be, but that we shall rather draw from the heart of suffering itself
the means of inspiration and survival, and of a victory won not only for ourselves, but for all. A victory won not only for our own time, but for the long and better days that are to come.
The Battle of Britain. Winston Churchill reads from his war memoirs, chapter 16.
We must take September the 15th as the culminating date of the air battle. On this day, the Luftwaffe, after two heavy attacks on the 14th, made its greatest concentrated effort in a resumed daylight attack on London. It was one of the decisive battles of the war, and like the Battle of Waterloo, it was on a Sunday. I was at Chequers. I had already on several occasions visited the headquarters of No. 11 Fighter Group, in order to witness the conduct of an air battle, when not much had happened. However, the weather on this day seemed suitable to the enemy, and accordingly I drove over to Uxbridge and arrived at the group headquarters. Number 11 group comprised no fewer than 25 squadrons, covering the whole of Essex, Kent, Sussex, and Hampshire, and all the approaches across them to London. Air Vice Marshal Park had for 6 months commanded this group, on which our fate largely depended. From the beginning of Dunkirk, all the daylight actions in the south of England had already been conducted by him, and all its arrangements and apparatus had been brought to the highest perfection. My wife and I were taken down to the bomb-proof operations room 50 feet below ground. All the ascendancy of the Hurricanes and Spitfires would have been fruitless but for this system of underground control centers and telephone cables which had been devised and built before the war by the Air Ministry under Dowding's advice and impulse. Lasting credit is due to all concerned. In the south of England there were at this time number 11 group headquarters and 6 subordinate fighter station centers. All these were, as has been described, under heavy stress. The supreme command was exercised from the fighter headquarters at Stanmore, but the actual handling of the direction of the squadrons was widely left to number 11 group, which controlled the units through its fighter stations located in each county. The group operations room was like a small theater, about 60 feet across and with 2 stories. We took our seats in the dress circle. Below us was the large-scale map table, around which perhaps 20 highly trained young men and women with their telephone assistants were assembled. Opposite to us, covering the entire wall, where the theater curtain would be, was a gigantic blackboard, divided into 6 columns with electric bulbs for the 6 fighter stations, each of their squadrons having a sub-column of its own and also divided by lateral lines. Thus the lowest row of bulbs showed, as they were lighted, the squadrons which were standing by at 2 minutes' notice, the next row those at readiness, 5 minutes, then at available, 20 minutes, then those which had taken off, the next row those which had reported having seen the enemy, the next with red lights, those which were in action, and the top row those which were returning home. On the left-hand side, in a kind of glass stage box, were the 4 or 5 officers whose duty it was to weigh and measure the information received from our observer corps, which at this time numbered upwards of 50,000 men, women, and youths. Radar was still in its infancy, but it gave warning of raids approaching our coast, and the observers with field glasses and portable telephones were our main source of information about radars flying overland. Thousands of messages were therefore received during an action. Several roomfuls of experienced people in other parts of the underground headquarters shifted them with great rapidity and transmitted the results from minute to minute directly to the plotters seated round the table on the floor and to the officer supervising from the glass stage box. On the right was another glass stage box containing army officers who reported the action of our anti-aircraft batteries, of which at this time in the command there were 200. At night, it was of vital importance to stop these batteries firing over certain areas in which our fighters would be closing with the enemy. I was not unacquainted with the general outlines of this system, having had it explained to me a year before the war by Dowding when I visited him at Stanmore. It had been shaped and refined in constant action, and all was now fused together into a most elaborate instrument of war, the like of which existed nowhere in the world. "I don't know," said Park, "if we went down, whether anything will happen today." After an hour, the raid plotters began to move about. An attack of 40-plus was reported to be coming from the German stations in the Dieppe area. The bulbs along the bottom of the wall display panel began to glow as various squadrons came to stand by. Then in quick succession, 20-plus, 40-plus signals were received, and in another 10 minutes it was evident that a serious battle impended. On both sides the air began to fill. One after another, signals came in, 40-plus, 60-plus, there was even an 80-plus. On the floor table below us, the movement of all the waves of attack was marked by pushing discs forward from minute to minute along different lines of approach, while on the blackboard facing us, the rising lights showed our fighter squadrons getting into the air, so there were only 4 or 5 left at readiness. These air battles, on which so much depended, lasted little more than an hour from the first encounter. The enemy had ample strength to send out new waves of attack, and our squadrons, having gone all out to gain the upper air, would have to refuel after 70 or 80 minutes, or land to rearm after a 5-minute engagement. If at this moment of refueling or rearming the enemy were able to arrive with fresh, unchallenged squadrons, some of our fighters could be destroyed on the ground. It was therefore one of our principal objects to direct our squadrons so as not to have too many on the ground refueling or rearming simultaneously during daylight. Presently the red bulb showed that the majority of our squadrons were engaged. A subdued hum arose from the floor where the busy plotters pushed their discs to and fro in accordance with the swiftly changing situation. The air marshal himself walked up and down behind, watching with vigilant eye every move in the game, supervising his junior executive hand, and only occasionally intervening with some decisive order, usually to reinforce a threatened area. In a little while, all our squadrons were fighting, and some had already begun to return to fuel. All were in the air. The lower line of bulbs was out. There was not one squadron left in reserve. At this moment, Park spoke to Dowding at Stanmore, asking for 3 squadrons from No. 12 Group to be put at his disposal in case of another major attack while his squadrons were rearming and refueling. This was done. They were specially needed to cover London and our fighter aerodromes because No. 11 Group had already shot their boat. The young officer to whom this seemed a matter of routine continued to give his orders in accordance with the general directions of his group commander, in a calm, low monotone. And the 3 reinforcing squadrons were soon absorbed. I became conscious of the anxiety of the commander, who now stood still behind his subordinate's chair. Hitherto I had watched in silence. I now asked, "What other reserves have we?" "There are none," said Air Vice Marshal Park. In an account which he wrote about it afterwards, he said that at this I looked grave. Well, I might. What losses should we not suffer if our refueling planes were caught on the ground by further raids of 40-plus or 50-plus? The odds were great, our margins small, the stakes infinite. Another 5 minutes passed, and most of our squadrons had now descended to refuel. In many cases, our resources could not give them overhead protection. Then it appeared that the enemy were going home. The shifting of the discs on the table below showed a continuous eastward movement of the German bombers and fighters. No new attack appeared. In another 10 minutes, the action was ended. We climbed again the stairways which led to the surface, and almost as we emerged, the all clear sounded. "We are very glad, sir, you have seen this," said Park. "Of course, during the last 20 minutes, we were so choked with information we couldn't handle it. This shows you the limitation of our present resources. They have been strained far beyond their limits today." I asked whether any results had come to hand, and remarked that the attack appeared to have been repelled satisfactorily. Park replied that he was not satisfied that we had intercepted as many raiders as he had hoped we should. It was evident that the enemy had everywhere pierced our defenses. Many scores of German bombers with their fighter escort had been reported over London. About a dozen had been brought down while I was below. But no picture of the results of the battle, or of the damage, or losses, could be obtained. It was 4:30 p.m. before I got back to Chequers, and I immediately went to bed for my afternoon sleep. I must have been tired by the drama of No. 11 Group, for I did not wait till 8. When I rang, John Martin, my principal private secretary, came in with the evening budget of news from all over the world. It was repellent. This had gone wrong here. That had been delayed there. An unsatisfactory answer had been received from so-and-so. There had been bad sinking in the Atlantic. "However," said Martin, as he finished this account, "all is redeemed by the air. We have shot down 183 for a loss of under 40. Although post-war information has shown that the enemy's losses on this day were only 56, September 15 was the crux of the Battle of Britain. That same night, our bomber command attacked in strength the shipping in the ports from Boulogne to Antwerp. At Antwerp, particularly heavy losses were inflicted. On September 17, as we now know, the Führer decided to postpone Ceylon indefinitely. It was not until October the 12th that the invasion was formally called off till the following spring. In July 1941, it was postponed again by Hitler till the spring of 1942, by which time the Russian campaign will be completed. So he said, this was a vain but an important imagining. On February the 13th, 1942, Admiral Raeder had his final interview on Sedan and got Hitler to agree to a complete stand down. Thus perished Operation Sedan, and September 15 may stand as the date of its demise.